Okay, so I don't have your test graded yet. They'll come back on Friday. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to move forward into new material. We're now at the part of the course where we're going to return back to more calculation oriented stuff. The principle.
I got on Discord because I was trying to play a little bit of Monster Hunter or Shingleton because I saw he was on.
Yeah.
And then he joined out of nowhere. I was like, Jacob, what are you doing on? He's like, oh, I'm just like this word. I'm word veneer algebra class. I'm like, Jacob, shut the fuck up, dude.
There we go. Okay. So what we're going to do today is discover a new calculation, one that, it relates back to a fundamental theorem we had, even before the first exam, that related, I'll put it up in a second, but it relates when you can actually find the inverse of a matrix. And it relates it to other things we discovered, like when can you solve a linear system and get a unique solution, et cetera. And so I'll introduce, there's going to be a particular function that will tell us, give us another equivalent condition. And then we'll explore that function for small matrices. The method in which I use to introduce it sort of breaks down, though, when the matrix starts to get even moderately large. So you'll see how that happens. We'll develop a better formula that now can be applied to any square matrix, n by n matrix. But that, in fact, is going to be a recursive formula. And so it's more of an algorithm than an actual closed formula for the determinant. But then I'll finish today's lecture with giving you a nice closed formula for the determinant. And you'll see exactly what kind of function the determinant of a matrix is. So I guess, let me see if I can get started here. All right, so if you remember, just prior to the first exam, we were looking at, see if I can drag this a little bit. Maybe not. There, yeah, I can drag it a little bit. When we were talking about inverses of matrices, we came up with the following theorem, which was called the fundamental theorem because it ties together lots of different ideas we had working with up to that point. So if you have any square matrix, same number of rows as you have columns, then there's what we had was five equivalent statements. One, the statement that this matrix has an inverse. And then, what's happening here? That's strange. All right, let me. Let me close this. I hope I have a better copy. Let's see. Oh, shoot. Okay. Well, I'm going to have to ad-lib this lecture, maybe. Unless one other thing could work here. All right, well, okay, so these slides are working. I don't have a fancy pauses or anything in it. Okay, so let me just remind you that we had a theorem back when we were discussing the inverses of matrices that related the existence of an inverse to other properties of the matrix. For example, if we do have an inverse, then we're always going to have a unique solution to any linear system that uses the matrix as a coefficient matrix. If A has an inverse, then this linear system is always going to have one and only one solution. Or another equivalent condition is that the equation AX equals zero, not some arbitrary vector B, but exactly the zero vector, then that only has one solution corresponding to X equals zero. That X equals zero is a solution. You just substitute the zero vector here, and a matrix times any zero vector is going to produce the zero vector. Or another way for to know that the inverse of a matrix exists is by row reducing the matrix. That's how you calculate the inverse of a matrix. If the matrix A row reduces to the identity matrix, then we know the inverse exists. And also, it turns out that the rank of the matrix, and rank is the dimension of the column space, for example. Well, how would you find the dimension of the column space? You would row reduce the matrix to row echelon form, and you would count the number of columns with pivots. Well, if the row echelon form is the identity matrix, then every column has a pivot. And so the number of linearly independent column vectors is going to be exactly equal to the number of columns. All right, so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to introduce yet another condition, so-called determinant function, which I haven't defined yet, but it's a function that that's actually going to be a polynomial in the entries of the matrix. So unlike the row reduction calculation that ties together these five conditions that we've studied previously, this time these conditions are linked by that row reduction algorithm, which I stress is an algorithm as opposed to a function. An algorithm is sort of it's a sequence of instructions, and you carry out one step and you see what results, and then depending on what results, you change, maybe use a different operation or a different technique, and you proceed to the next step until eventually you're led to a final result. But the thing about working with algorithms, though, is you don't really see the answer until you reach the last step. But on the other hand, if we had a polynomial in A that if simply we check to make sure when we evaluate that polynomial, we don't get zero, that would be, we could just stare at the entries of the matrix and perhaps deduce these consequences without having to do any row reduction. And what I'll show you eventually, probably not this week, but early next week, is that this determinant function can actually be used to avoid row reduction. We can solve linear equations without doing any row reduction as long as we can readily compute determinants. We can, in fact, find the inverse of a matrix simply by computing a bunch of determinants. So that's what's coming. But the way we're going to introduce this thing is I'm going to look for a function of the entries of a matrix that will tell me when the matrix is invertible or not. So let me step through some, and then the idea is that once we have this function on n by n matrices defined, then we can decide whether a given matrix in this set, we can decide whether it is invertible or not, simply by evaluating that function. All right, so here's an example that will clarify what I'm saying here. Suppose we have a 1x1 matrix. So it just has a single entry. And I want to know conditions for which this simple matrix is going to be invertible. Well, that means I'm looking for a matrix B that when I multiply A times it, I get the identity matrix. So let's construct another 1x1 matrix. We multiply these together. The rule for matrix multiplication is single column in each. So I just multiply those together. Now, the 1x1 identity matrix would be the 1x1 matrix where the only entry is 1. So what I need is A times B to equal 1, or B is equal to 1 divided by A. All right, so here's a function I'm going to define on any 1x1 matrix. It's just going to be the sole entry of that matrix. And then this little calculation here shows is that this matrix is going to be invertible only if 1 over A, only if A is not equal to 0. Because you can't divide. You'd have to solve for B, but if A is equal to 0, this division by 0 wouldn't make sense. So if this is our function, the fact that the determinant is not equal to 0 means A is not equal to 0, which means we will be able to find that invertible matrix. So this is the first example of a determinant function. This function of the entries of a 1x1 matrix, if it's equal to 0, then the matrix is not invertible because I won't be able to construct this auxiliary matrix B. But if it's, as long as it's non-zero, then this can be calculated and we will have an inverse. Okay, so that's simple. I'm going to declare now that the determinant of a 1x1 matrix is defined as its only entry. All right, now that's a simple function. But let's move on to more complicated ones. Here we have a 2x2 matrix. I'm going to apply the same logic. I'm going to look for a function of the entries A, B, C, and D that when I evaluate it for particular numbers A, B, C, and D, if that number is non-zero, I know the matrix is invertible. If it's equal to zero, then the matrix is supposed to be not invertible. All right, so we'll look at this matrix and recall from our fundamental theorem that an inverse of a matrix exists if and only if the reduced or echelon form of that matrix is the identity matrix. That's coming from the way you calculate an inverse, right? If you want to find A to the minus first, what you do is you form this double matrix, the original matrix A and the identity matrix, and you row reduce to reduce row echelon form. And then what happens is one of two things. Either you get this side row reduces to the identity matrix, and you get A to the minus first here, or you get something else. And on the other side, well, it doesn't make any difference. If you're in this, when the left-hand side does not reduce to the identity matrix, then the inverse does not exist. And so this calculation shows you that you only have an inverse of a matrix when A reduces to the identity matrix. So that's what we're going to use. We're going to try to reduce this matrix to the identity matrix and see if there are anything that prevents us from doing that. All right, so here's the calculation. Here we start off with our general 2x2 matrix. The idea is I'm going to try to rewrite it in reduced row echelon form. So the first thing I need to do is get rid of this pivot here. So that's done by that row operation. It leads to this. Well, in fact, the first thing I did is I renormalized the pivot in the upper corner to 1 by dividing the first row by A. And then I clear out this pivot below the pivot in the first row by doing a multiple of the first row and subtracting it from the second row. That leads me to this. And then what the next thing I'd want to do is get it's in row echelon form now, and there's no obstruction to these, well, except maybe dividing by A, but there's no obstruction to this calculation up to this point. The last step would be, well, we want to get this pivot in the second row. We want to get it equal to 1. So to do that, Well, let's see. I guess what I did is I simplified the... I just multiply the second row to get rid of that denominator. And now to get rid of, to make that pivot in the second row equal to 1, I'd have to divide by AD minus BC. But as long as I can divide by AD minus BC, I'll be able to convert this entry into 1, and then I can use the 1 there to clear out the entry there. So what I'm trying to show you in this calculation is the row reduction of a general 2x2 matrix to a matrix that's to an a matrix in the form of an identity matrix. What a crucial step in the calculation is this last step here, where you have to divide the second row by AD minus BC. If that number is equal to 0, I won't be able to get rid of this guy. I mean, that means this guy would be equal to 0, and it would not be row reducible to the identity matrix. So the main thing I need to complete this row reduction is for A, this product of entries, A times D minus B times C. I need that to not equal to 0, so that the row reduction will proceed all the way to the identity matrix. All right, so what this calculation then shows is that a general 2x2 matrix can be row reduced to the identity matrix only if this combination of the entries, or of the matrix entries, does not equal to 0. And of course, being row reducible to the identity matrix, this condition is equivalent to A to minus first exists. So we have a function. It's actually a quadratic function, right? It's of degree 2 in the variables. Here's a degree 1, degree 1. Add degrees, you get a degree 2 term. This is degree 2 term. So we have a function of the entries of a 2x2 matrix that, when that function is not equal to 0, our inverse is going to exist. When the function does equal 0, the inverse is not going to exist. And that's the function I'm advertising, is the one we're interested in. A function that simply upon evaluation will allow us to decide whether a matrix is invertible or not. Okay, so we can continue like this. I did the 1x1 case. 1x1, that's a matrix. This is invertible. If and only if determinant of A, determinant of that 1x1 matrix, defined as the sole entry of that matrix, does not equal 0. If this determinant does not equal 0, that's equivalent to, if that does not equal 0, then that's equivalent to this matrix having an inverse. And what we've just done on this slide, it's look at a 2x2 matrix, A, B, C, D, is invertible if and only if the determinant of that matrix, A, B, C, D, and now I have a definition for it. I want it to be this function AD minus BC. If that does not equal 0, then this matrix will be invertible. So in fact, let me give you a explicit example. Does the inverse of this matrix exist? Well, what we'll do is we'll calculate its determinant. So we'd have, it's the difference of the diagonal product. So I have 1 times 4, the determinant of 1, 2, 3, 4. It's going to equal 1 times 4 minus 2 times 3. And so that's going to be 4 minus 6, or negative 2. Since that doesn't equal the number, negative 2 does not equal the number 0, I know that this matrix has an inverse, even though I'm not computing its determinant. Now, that tells us not only that A does not have a determinant, If the determinant of A is not equal to zero, not only do we know that A, the minus first, exists, but we also know that these other four statements are also true about A. And so this this one function is actually giving us a lot of information about the matrix A, telling us whether it has an inverse, what it's like, what it's going to be, what's going to happen if we try to solve a linear system using that matrix as a coefficient matrix. It tells us that if we try to row reduce this matrix, take this matrix, if I try to row reduce it, I know it's going to row reduce to the identity matrix. And I did that not by explicitly performing the row reduction calculation, but rather evaluating a particular function of the entries of that matrix. And if that function is not equal to zero, then all five of these conditions will be true for the given matrix. Okay, so let's move forward a little bit. I've done it for one by one matrices, two by two matrices. I won't repeat the calculation for a three by three matrix. But what happens for three by three matrices, you can again try to manually row reduce this matrix to get it in reduced row echelon form and look for obstructions that would keep that reduced row echelon form from being the identity matrix. And what you'll find is that this particular function of the entries of the given matrix, so long as this function does not equal zero, then you will be able to row reduce the given matrix to row echelon form. So its inverse will exist, it will have unique solutions, and all the other conditions in the fundamental theorem will follow. Okay, now, the problem I have in presenting this stuff, though, is that about this stage, and in fact, I don't even do the calculation for a three by three matrix, it gets really complicated to try to figure out to row reduce a matrix with symbolic entries where you have to keep track of all the variables instead of adding integers together and simplifying. Things stay just as complicated as the original presentation. So what we're going to do next then is find a way of generalizing the results I stated so far in a way that will allow me to define a determinant of an arbitrary n by n matrix, but without resorting explicitly to this row reducibility argument. What I'm instead going to do is going to look at the pattern that sort of comes out of the three cases we have been able to do, and then we'll generalize that pattern. So here's the idea. The key thing in the discussion now is going to be we start off with a matrix of arbitrary size, but still going to have the same number of rows as we have columns. From any n by n matrix, we can construct a bunch of smaller matrices. The way we construct them is we take an entry of the matrix, and we eliminate from the matrix the column and the row that contains the entry. So look at this entry A. If I remove the column that contains it and the row that contains it, I'm left with a smaller matrix. I started with a 3 by 3, but after removing a row and a column, I'm left with a 2 by 2 matrix. We call this 2 by 2 matrix EFHI, the 1-2 minor corresponding to the 1-1 entry of the matrix. See, this entry here is sitting in the first row and first column. That's what these indices represent, first row, first column. Once I eliminate the first row and the first column from this matrix, I'm left with a smaller matrix, EFHI. That's going to be called the 1-1 minor of the original matrix. This next matrix, also 2 by 2, I get it by looking at the matrix, the entry in the first row, second column of the original matrix, so this entry B here. I eliminate the column that contains it and the row that contains it, and what survives is DFGI. So I've got a 2 by 2 matrix associated with this entry. And similarly, I can look at this entry, eliminate its row and column, and I'm left with a smaller matrix that's going to be DEGH. So these are called minors. You create them by looking at particular entries in your given matrix, removing from the matrix the column and row that contains it, you'll be left with a smaller matrix. So here's the point of that. This determinant of a 3x3 matrix, which I said a row reduction argument would tell you that as long as this function of the entries of the matrix does not equal to zero, as long as that determinant does not equal zero, I'll know that this matrix is invertible. Well, here's a replication of that formula, but now in terms of these so-called minor matrices. This is A, and what is EI minus FH? Well, it's the difference of the diagonal products, right? E times I minus F times H. So this is A times the determinant of this 1-1 minor. This next term here is the second entry times the determinant of the 1-2 minor, right? It'd be D times I minus F times G, exactly what you get here. And then this third term here is the third entry in the first row times the determinant of the corresponding minor. So this is the 1-3 entry. I create the 1-3 minor, and then I take its determinant to be DH minus G, EG. So this gives us a way of understanding how we might generalize these formulas for the determinant that we have previously done. So for example, even for a 2x2 matrix, I defined it as the difference of the diagonal products. But I can also think of it as A times, well, what's the minor corresponding to this guy? It's only going to be a single entry. It's going to be D. So this term AD, you can think of as the entry in the 1-1 slot times the determinant of the corresponding minor. Determinant of a 1x1 matrix is just the entry D. And similarly, the next term would be B. Its associated minor would be the matrix with sole entry C. And so this expression for our determinant can also be thought as an expression where we march across the first row of the matrix and we multiply the entries by the accompanying determinants of the accompanying minor. All right, so what does this do for us? If this formula holds in general, then what we can do is for a large matrix, we can steadily reduce the size of the matrix for which we actually have to explicitly compute determinants. So if I start off with a matrix with n rows and n columns, what I can do is, here's my formula for the determinant. What you do is you march across the first row in this case, and then for each term in that row, you'll get the corresponding entry, and then there'll be a determinant of a matrix. But what I'm doing here is this is actually the determinant of a smaller matrix. If this is n by n, after eliminating one row and one column, I'm left with a matrix that is going to be n minus 1 by n minus 1. It'll have one less row and one less column. So this will be a smaller matrix. And then if this formula holds in general, I can again reduce the determinant of this n minus 1 matrix by n minus 1 matrix. I could expand along its first row, and I can reduce the computation of this determinant into the computation of a bunch of n minus 2 by n minus 2 matrices. And you can steadily break things down until eventually you've got everything expressed as the determinant of maybe a 2x2 matrix, or if you want to go all the way, you can bring it down to everything is expressed in terms of the determinant of a 1x1 matrix. So let me, I think I do an example of such a computation. Yeah, here we go. So here's an explicit matrix, a 4x4 matrix, and the way I propose to calculate its determinant is by using this expansion formula. So the original matrix, its determinant can be computed in terms of the determinants of its minors. So the formula is going to be, we'll march across the first row, we'll grab an entry, and then we'll create the corresponding minor. So for this entry, The minor is 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, and 0, 2, 1. That's what I've got here. And then I have 0 times the corresponding minor. Well, eliminate the row and column that contain this entry, and you're left with, let's see, the row and column. So, but you're left with 1, 0, 1. Things got somewhat split. I get 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and 1, 2, 1. Yeah, so one thing to point out here is as I march across these a given row, the first term comes in with a plus sign, second term comes in with a minus sign, third term comes in with a plus sign and a minus sign. So another feature of this formula is to recognize that the terms coming with alternating sign. Every other term, there's a sign flip. But you get a nice closed formula. And now what I could do if I wanted to complete the determinant calculation of this determinant is I could look at this matrix and I could do a cofactor expansion here. It basically would be 0 times the determinant of this matrix minus 0 times the determinant of this matrix plus 1 times the determinant of this 2x2 matrix. And then that would produce the determinant of this 3x3 matrix. And you'd have to similarly break this down into a bunch of 2x2 matrices, determinants of 2x2 matrices, and you can break this down, both of those down into a sum over determinants of 2x2 matrices. But before I do that, and I will do that, I'm gonna generalize that formula a little bit because the way I've stated it, that first row sounds kind of special, when in fact, these kind of expansions, you're not confined to just doing looking along the first row and multiplying corresponding entries times their corresponding minors. In fact, you could have do a similar expansion along the second row, along the third row, along the fourth row, or up and down any column. The only thing this formula requires is that you multiply entries of the matrix by the determinant of the corresponding minors. All right, so here's the more general formula that will work no matter which row you choose or no matter which column you choose. Mostly, the formula looks exactly the same in the two cases. What's different between these two lines is in the first line, I'm keeping this index I, which tells you which row I'm looking at. That's not changing. What I'm summing over here are the columns. So here I fix a row index, and then I look at the entries in each column for that row. And depending on the sum of the row index and the sign index, I get a plus or minus sign here. But then I have the entry in the ij slot times a sign that comes by looking at the parity of the sum of the row index and the column index. And then you have the determinant of that minor that's associated with the ijth entry. Okay, so so in these formulas, this combination here where I take a minor corresponding to the ith row and jth column of a given matrix, and I take its determinant, and I multiply it by a sign factor that depends on the position of the entry within the matrix A, that's called a cofactor. And we call these expressions for the determinant cofactor expansions because each term in these formulas involves a cofactor. It just depends on whether we want to add up all the cofactors along a given row, in which case we use fix I, we fix the row index, and we use this formula. Here are the cofactors. And or we can fix a column index and move up and down a column computing factors like this. Here's the cofactor corresponding to the ijth entry of the matrix. But the way we get the determinant is we march down a column multiplying entries by their corresponding cofactors. But the point of this more general formula is it doesn't matter which row or column we use. We always get the same result. So whether I use this formula and I use row 1, or I use this formula and I use column 10, I would still get the number that's produced is always going to be the same. That's not at all obvious, but it turns out to be true. And I'll show you, if I have time, I'll show you a little bit why that's true. But let's first do this computation. So here we had a 4x4 matrix. And what I had done so far is I looked at the cofactor expansion along that first row. So I have the 1-1 entry times the determinant of the corresponding cofactor. And then I have the 1-2 entry, which is 0. Well, that's going to multiply a certain determinant, but because this factor is going to equal 0, it's not going to contribute, so we can ignore it. Here we have a non-zero entry, so it's going to contribute to the computation of the determinant. It'll be that entry times the determinant of the corresponding minor. So for this entry, we remove the first row and the third column. We're left with 101, 010, and 101. And then this last entry here, because it's equal to 0, this 0 would be multiplying a determinant, because I have a factor of 0, I'm only going to get a contribution of 0. All right, and then I've reduced the computation of the determinant of this 4x4 matrix, and I've reduced it to the computing 2 3x3 determinants. Well, here's one. I can compute this determinant of a 3x3 matrix by marching across the first row again. 0 times the determinant of 1102, minus 0 times the determinant of, I guess that will be 1001, and then 1 times the determinant, well, the corresponding minor is in this case 1102. And so I take a 3x3 matrix, I can break it down into a sum of determinants of 2x2 matrices. And then these determinants, I'll just use the cross diagonal product formula. Determinant of 1021 is 1 times 1 minus 0 times 2, which is going to be 0. Well, this is multiplied by 0. And then this term is going to be 1 times 1 times 2 minus 1 times 0. And in the end, you get 2. And similarly, for this guy here, you can do, you could do a cofactor expansion along the first row again. But remember, when you have a row or column that has lots of zeros in it, that's going to mean you're going to have determinants that you won't have to compute because they're being multiplied by 0. So to compute the determinant of this matrix, rather than do the cofactor expansion along the first row, we can go down the second column, because I'll have 0 times the determinant of a minor, but I won't have to compute that determinant. I'll have 1 times the determinant of 1111. I'll have to compute that. And then I'll have 0 times the determinant of 1001. But in either case, for this contribution of this term, I'm going to get 0 because the entry is 0. Here we have a non-zero entry, so we're going to have to compute that minor, the determinant of the minor. Here's the factor, 1. Here's a sign correction that depends on which row and which column the entry lives. So when the row and column indices add up to an even number, this is just a factor of 1. When they add up to an odd number, I get a factor of minus 1. It's a simple enough rule. And then we have the determinant of the corresponding minor, which is 1111. Well, here we can compute this. 1 times 1 minus 1 times 1 is going to equal 0. So it turns out that the determinant of that matrix is going to equal 0, which, by the way, tells me that this matrix is not invertible. I don't have to do any row reduction. As soon as I know that its determinant is equal to zero, I know I won't be able to row reduce that matrix to the identity matrix. Okay, so to complete the calculation, we had a 4x4 matrix. We expressed this determinant via a cofactor expansion along the first row. That's this line here. And then I calculated, using similar cofactor expansions, the determinant of this 3x3 and this determinant of that 3x3. And what worked out to be was 1 times this determinant was 2, and 2 times, well, the determinant of that matrix was 0. And so I just get 2. So in general, when you're looking at determinants of 3x3, 4x4, or larger matrices, there is a formula that you can apply that will allow you to calculate the determinants in terms of smaller matrices. But if you have a 6x6 matrix, first time you apply the formula, you get a sum of a bunch of determinants of 5x5 matrices. Well, that doesn't help. So you apply the formula again, and then you reduce each determinant of a 5x5 to a 4x4. And you reduce those to determinants of 3x3s. And then maybe when you get it down to the determinants of 2x2, you can use that cross diagonal product formula for the determinants to actually get the an explicit number. So what happens here is the calculation of the determinant, eventually you have to employ an algorithm in order to compute it. You have to steadily reduce the size of the determinants that you need to compute until you get one that's maybe 2x2. And so you just use the formula for a 2x2 matrix. Well, there is a closed formula for a 3x3, but it's harder to remember. And you may as well just reduce all the way to 2x2. Okay, so the good thing about it, these determinants, is once you know what that function is, all you have to do is insert the values of the entries of your matrix into that function, evaluate it. If you get 0, you know the matrix can be it's not invertible. If you get a number other than 0, the matrix is invertible. What I'm going to show you next, though, is a closed formula for the determinant that, unfortunately, in practice, it's going to be just as hard to compute, but its form is going to tell you a little bit more about what sort of function this determinant is. So to introduce that, I need to introduce some auxiliary concepts. The first is the idea of a permutation. So if I take the numbers 1, 2, and 3, I can write them in various orders. I can keep 1 in the first slot, but then I can reverse the positions of 2 and 3. I get a new ordering of the numbers 1, 3, and 2. What I've listed here are the 6 possible ways of taking numbers 1, 2, and 3 and writing them in a particular order. So those orderings of a list of numbers between 1 and n is called up the permutations of n. And when I write a list of numbers in a strict order, like this, I'll call that the standard permutation. So this would be the standard permutation, and these are non-standard permutations where I've taken these things, these entries, out of their natural order. Okay, I need one more bit of information that I will attach to these permutations. This would be a so-called sign of or parity of a permutation. What this is, it's the way you get this sine function, it's either going to be plus 1 or minus 1. The way you assign a plus sign or a minus sign to a given permutation is you look at the entries and you count the number of times the entries are out of order. So for this one, in this one, we have effectively 3 different kinds of pairs, 1, 2, 2 pairs with 3, and 1 pairs with 3. What I'm going to do is look at each of those pairings and decide whether they occur in the matrix in order or not. So here, 1 precedes 2, they're in order. 2 precedes 3, and 1 precedes 3. So these numbers are in perfect order. And so this number S, which counts the number of times they're out of order, is going to equal zero. For this permutation, one still precedes two, and but three doesn't precede two. So the three and two are out of order here. But one and three are in order, three and two are out of order, and one and two are still in order. So there's one sort of order discrepancy for this permutation. For this one, I guess, if I simply switch back, I get these things in order. So these things are out of order once. Two is should be after one. It precedes it. But one is before three, and two is before three. So the other pairings are in order. So the way you ascribe a number plus or minus one is you count, you look at pairs of the entries, and you decide the number of times when you read across this list, the entries appear out of order. So this is stated this way. These indices I and J are telling you the position that a given entry is occurring. So here I and J can be in the first slot, second slot, or the third slot. So those would be the allowed values for those indices. But then you have the numbers themselves as well, not their position in the list, but their actual numbers. And so if the numbers are out of order, but the row indices are in order, that's when you have the discrepancy, and that's what we're trying to count. All right, so for example, for 1, 2, and 3, here I've explicitly counted the number of times. Here are the three possible pairings we have, and I've just scanned across each of these, and I count the number of times we're out of order. 2 and 1 are out of order, 2 and 3 are in order, and 1 and 3 are in order. So I get a plus sign for this out of order pair, but the other two pairings are in order, so I just get zeros. And then this way I can ascribe us a particular sign, a plus sign or a minus sign, to a given permutation. Okay, so here's the formula I wanted to present. The determinant of an n by n matrix is a polynomial. See here, I just have, think of these as your variables. This is just a product of n variables. And in fact, they're exactly, this is the entry of the first row in the sigma 1 column. So sigma 1 is going to be some number between 1 and n. It's not necessarily equal to 1. So what is this in this formula here? Each term, I have an entry from each row. So I'm just changing the row indexes. I move across factors. But these column indices, the column index I use on a given entry, it depends on which permutation I'm looking at. But what this determinant formula tells you is that the determinant of an n by n matrix is a polynomial of degree n, because I have these are all variables, and I have exactly n factors there. So it's a polynomial of degree n, where each term has an entry, has a term from each row, and also a term from each column of the original matrix. And so this is all the possible ways of grabbing an entry in the first row and pairing it with entries in other rows, but entries that live in different columns. And then there's this simple sign factor that depends on which permutation we're looking at. But what this tells us is something a little bit more function theoretic about this, now, this determinant function. It displays it as a polynomial. It also tells us how big that polynomial, how many different terms you have. To get that, you have to count the number of possible permutations. But if you have the numbers 1 through n, and you want to rearrange these guys in some list, well, for this first entry here, you have n choices. But then once you go to the next entry, sigma 2 here, I've used up one choice. I've already decided my first entry is sigma 1. So for this second entry here, There's one choice that's missing because I've already used it. And so I'll get n minus one choices here. And when I get to the third entry, I've used up two choices, so I'll only have n minus three choices for that. And then you count up the possibilities. You have n choices times n minus one choices times n minus two choices. The total number of choices you have for setting up terms like this is going to be n times n minus one times n minus two, or exactly n factorial. So in fact, this is a pretty big polynomial. If you think about, for 3 by 3, we're looking at permutations of 3. There are exactly 6 of those. Notice that 6 is 3 factorial. If I had 4, I would be looking at a polynomial of degree 4 with 4 factorial terms, or 24 terms. Let's go up a little bit higher, and I'll let you go. If we had a polynomial of degree or determinant of a 5 by 5 matrix, I'm going to have a determinant that has 5 factorial terms. 5 factorial is 4, is 5 times 4 factorial. It's going to equal 120. For a 6 by 6 matrix, there's going to be 6 times 120, 720 different terms. So these functions, while it's kind of simple to write down in a nice closed formula, it's extremely complicated, even for moderately large matrices. It's a polynomial that can have really an incredible number of terms, even for a moderately large matrix like an 8 by 8 matrix. Okay, so I'll stop here today. I'm sorry I ran 5 minutes over. My God. I apologize for that. Maybe I'll let you guys go early on a Friday.
Is there like a pencil case left here after a test by any chance?
I didn't notice anything, yeah. Sometimes they treat this like a lost and found, but nothing today.